The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Monica Castera is a professor of management, and she is the author of the book After the Apocalypse, Finding Hope in Organizing, which is coming out from Zero Books in September. It's Thursday, August 13th, 2020, and I'm Douglas Lane, the host of this podcast and the publishing manager for Zero Books. If you enjoy our podcasts, remember to support us on Patreon. For $5 a month or more, you can get access to all of our podcasts. Supporting us on Patreon keeps these podcasts coming, it keeps our YouTube channel operative, and it makes the publicity we do online, the digital work we do online, possible. The music you're listening to right now is video game music from Super Mario Brothers, but in just a moment, you'll be listening to Monica and I discuss Hope in Organizing. Monica Castera is a Polish economist, professor of management, and organization theorist. She's known for her contribution to business studies, organizational archetypes and myths, storytelling, and narrative analysis. And she is the author of After the Apocalypse, Finding Hope in Organizing. It's due out from Zero Books in September. Monica, welcome to the Zero Books podcast.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me to the podcast.
I guess what I want to start with is trying to figure out what your definition or working definition of organizing is, or what an organization is. Is an organization or something that is organized different from a society or a culture? Is it something inside of society or culture, or is it, can it be, can we organize the totality?
That would be quite difficult. Organization is similar to society and culture, but it's smaller. It's not as all-embracing. And by that, I don't mean smaller in size, because there are many different sizes of organizations. Some can be really, really small, just a few people, and some are enormous, gigantic, employing or bringing together millions of people, like the Solidarity movement in Poland in the 1980s, in the early 1980s. It had 10 million members. So that's really huge. But the difference is between these two, and we usually speak of organizations being on the meso level. The society is macro. It's small groups and individuals, families are micro, and organizations are in between. It's the meso level. But the huge difference is that they are usually not all embracing. People don't spend their entire lives in just one organization. Even the total organizations like prisons or hospitals do not strive at embracing the entire life of a human being. So they are sort of in between, and whether it is possible to go beyond that, well, how would you say, entity is a very important question, because there are, of course, leaders, authoritarian leaders, who have aspirations to do just that, to form totalitarian organizations. to turn whole societies and countries into a totalitarian organization. And at times, unfortunately, in history, this has been successful, but fortunately not always.
Yeah, I think, you know, that what you described is sort of my working definition of an organization is, you know, as a micro social form within a larger society. But at times it seems like you're hoping that by organizing that we can transform that large level. I mean, I think that is the aim that you're talking about in your book. And you wrote that right now we're in an interregnum or a period of transition from one form of self-organization to another. So in a sense, even the world, you know, system of global capitalism is a form of organization, of self-organization. Is that, would you say that's true or?
Yeah, certainly. There are, maybe it's what I wouldn't call it organization because it's more systemic. Capitalism is a huge macro system, but it has some organized features, and it certainly tries to organize our lives and our societies and our cultures. It offers an organizing principle that is very pervasive. And what we are witnessing right now is what sociologist Zygmunt Bauman calls the interregnum after Antonio Gramsci. So he proposes that the big system, the huge structures of that system are beginning or were beginning to erode some time ago. And right now they are more or less crumbling. So we have huge changes going on in all countries, everywhere, globally. And these changes don't look very nice. It's certainly a difficult time to live in.
Traditional socialist understanding of capitalism would be that it's a kind of organizing that takes place behind our backs. So it's not the sort of self-directed organizing, but we are organized by economic relations. Marx talked about how we have material relationships between people and social relationships between things in our world. But the aim of a socialist politics, I think, would be to be able to take hold of society and self-organize. That's sort of the fantasy of maybe of centralized planning being the way out of capitalism, is to have some sort of body that can consciously and rationally organize the world. That wouldn't be my preferred way of replacing capitalism, but do you see what I'm getting at here? So are, in a way, is organizing itself a goal for society to be able to, rather than be organized by these systems, to develop the system ourselves and to organize ourselves?
Yes, I think that it's more or less, or I agree with you that the top-down aspiration to plan and organize society is perhaps not the replacement, the best replacement of capitalism, not from my point of view either. I wouldn't call it a socialism. It's more like state socialism or state communism. It's still hierarchical and it's still going on behind our backs, like you were saying. But the prominence of the economic dimension of ownership of capital is replaced by a political economic dimension. You still have ownership of capital, but now it is the state that is the owner of capital. So we still have a kind of capitalism in the end, and it's certainly not democratic. No, what my favorite kind of, or what I would dream of as a replacement of the system that is currently crumbling, is a democratic socialism where you have more democratic and living organizational forms going on all levels of society. So therefore, I believe that organization will be hopefully even more important in the future than it is now, because the dependency structures, which used to be quite solid based on capital, will hopefully tend to be replaced by democratic organizational forms, which are not hierarchical.
The key to point that I was trying to raise when I mentioned centralized planning was not so much the hierarchical form, but that is, I mean, in the 20th century, that is the way really existing socialists attempted to take hold of the world, really, and organize it. But more that it's a moving away of from a society or a culture that seems to be an objective fact out beyond us that we're within, and more towards understanding society as an organization, as something that we are doing. And, you know, the fact that there's a central authority, a centralized authority, and a party that's sort of representing the masses, or, you know, in strict socialist terms, the working classes, to, you know, do this for them, or as an extension. I mean, the way they would justify this, and the way I think they thought of it, was that the party was an extension of the working class will, and that it was what could do the thinking for the working class, and help organize a new society. But, you know, if you put aside the question of democracy or centralized authority, and just look at the aim of taking hold of our society and our culture as our own product, as a kind of organization, I think that would be the most important point that I was trying to raise, because then the distinction between, you know, culture and society and our own kind of organizing maybe falls away. And also the idea that we'll remain within the same organization would fall away, because we would be free to organize again.
Yeah, I agree. It would be more emphasis on the process, the process of organizing, and it would, of course, demand more activity and more consciousness, more conscious participation, and the knowledge that it would be based on would also be slightly different. So we would need to learn how to cooperate. Right now, we're mostly learning how to compete with each other, but we would need to learn how to cooperate with each other. We would also need to develop a broader understanding of the common good, of the commons, because the commons, which are an extremely good way of organizing society of this kind, of the democratic kind, also need or even demand a very intensive and extensive knowledge, which is both historical. We need to know about the different kinds of commons which we participate in, its history, traditions. There are lots of those. Culture and the norms and values and the technical issues connected to the particular commons and so on and so on. So there is a lot of knowledge to be learned and to be developed, and much of it is of the humanistic kind. I mean, more humanities, not just the STEM kind of knowledge, which has been so overprivileged in the recent decades. So based on this, we would be able to develop maybe not entirely new, because there are many traditional forms of managing appropriate for the common good, but we could sort of develop them more and adapt them to the more complex need of contemporary society.
I'm hearing you edge towards one of the major themes in your book, which has to do with the importance of narratives. I mean, when you move away from the kind of knowledge that we'd find in the sciences or in STEM, and towards a more humanitarian, or, you know, towards the humanities, I see you moving towards that, the significance of narratives, and I want to get to that. But before we do, I want to ask you about the word apocalypse, which is in your title, and which I think is informing your outlook in the book. How are you using the word apocalypse? And because I think of the word as meaning two different things. It means like a collapse or an ending, but it also means the ripping away of a veil and the exposure of reality, of a loss of illusion. I think that's my rough understanding of the word apocalypse.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I use it in both these significant, or I mean, sorry, not being a native speaker, I sometimes lose words. I use it in both these understandings. The metaphor of the sociological apocalypse I owe to Zygmunt Bauman and his interregnum, the way he understands interregnum as the falling apart of the structures and central institutions of modernity. And in this process of falling apart, what I have noticed as a researcher of organizations and organizing, I have named, or I have tried to understand and explore with the help of the metaphor of the sociological apocalypse, which is exactly what you described. It's the destruction. It's the horrendous even image of the destructive force of structures which are falling apart, and which are not longer working the way that they used to. In, for example, in the 60s or 70s, which Zygmunt Bauman called the solid modern era. So after that, according to Bauman, came the liquid modern era, where the neoliberal era, where the structures weren't as solid anymore, but they still were sort of functional based on the so-called entrepreneurial principle. But what we have right now is more of a crumbling of these structures and institutions, and this looks very, very horrifying. And so it's a difficult time to live in. But at the same time, it also, the original term, apocalypsis, the Greek apocalypsis, means revelation. It's like you said, a veil is lifted and we can see things that were invisible until now. And these things, these invisible things, were invisible because they used to be the foundation of these structures and institutions. So they we couldn't see them because they were covered by the modern system.
One of our previous authors, David Blacker, wrote a book that was influenced by Zygmunt Bauman, and he was very much interested in myths and narratives as well. Because of that, I think he was influenced by Bauman in that direction. And he was one of the things he wrote about was the proliferation of identities, and the both on the right and the left. So, like for the alt-right, the need to try to cling to some sort of imagined Western strong
masculine identity he thought was a byproduct of liquid modernity and maybe this apocalyptic moment as well. And also he looked at the proliferation of gender identities as another symptom, maybe in the opposite direction of the multiplicity of gender identities being an attempt to find some sort of, I guess, heroic identity inside of a world which was always changing, that one could cling to. So, what I want to ask you is how can we distinguish between this moment of liquid modernity and dissolution? And also, you know, I'm not that familiar with Sigmund Bauman. I've discovered him through David Blacker's work. And I admire him because he was someone who kept working into his 90s. I mean, he died in 2017 at the age of 91, but he was still like being interviewed a year before his death.
Yeah, absolutely. He was writing until the very end, until the last day.
Yeah, I mean, that's the life you want, I think. So what I want to ask is, well, first, how do you understand liquid modernity as opposed to apocalypse? I guess maybe we go from liquid to gas. but do you think we are really have left the realm of liquid modernity? And another way of putting that, I guess, is are we beyond the neoliberal epoch or age?
Well, I think Bauman himself would have said that we're not out of the liquid modernity yet, even though we have a period of interregnum where the liquid modernity is visibly and ostensibly not working anymore. But it's still based on the same principles, the neoliberal principles of discontinuity, of fragmentations, of instability. And at the same time, the same narrative is dominant. It's a hyper-rational narrative where, and even not just hyper-rational, but financialized. So everything has to be accounted for in financial terms. And this combined with it's a way of rationalizing the picture that we have before our eyes right now with the epidemics and with the destruction of the natural environment. So in that era, it is almost impossible to really make sense of what is happening. And therefore, and this is one of Sigmund's ideas, the identity crisis, identity has been serving as a replacement for meaning. This is a notion I also have been quite inspired by, the notion of the identity as a substitute for meaning. So for example, it is a attempt to bind people together in a fragmented society. Instead of solidarity, you have the rather artificial notion of people being identical somehow, because identity means that we are identical, based on a large number of different factors, gender being one of them. And then you have the idea that you can have gender without class, which is absurd, that gender comes before class, or that it can be taken apart from class.
Now, why is that absurd? I think I know, but what would your reason be for saying that you can't understand gender before you understand class?
Because we live in capitalism, as we said before,
yeah,
and capitalism strives to organize our lives in ways that make class a central concept. Not just concept, it is a reality, a central reality. Either we are capitalists, owners of capital, or we are people who need to support themselves and who are owned also in part, our work, our labor is owned by the owners of capital. So we cannot be free. The whole rhetoric of freedom is as false as all the identity talk.
Right. Maybe in a previous era, we would say we can't understand gender as apart from caste. In a feudal society,
yeah.
Right? I mean, what it means to be a woman of the aristocracy is something very different than what it means to be a woman of peasant stock.
Exactly. Mm. So it's a huge difference between a working class woman or a working woman, a person who is supporting herself through her work, and a celebrity or a businesswoman. There are not so many things in common as the rhetorics, identity rhetorics, would want us to believe.
So that gets me to, I guess, the question about narratives now, because it seems to me that when you look at the capitalist world, that while there are many narratives that influence us, for instance, the narrative, you know, when thinking about gender, in the 70s and 80s, there was a commercial on American television where it's like you could be a Maybelline woman, where you could bring home the bacon and then, but still be alluring. Like you could go to work all day, come home at night, dress well, greet your man, make him dinner, then, you know, seduce him into bed. It's all like 30-second ad about being a Maybelline woman.
'Cause I'm a woman, Angelique. I can bring home a bacon, Angelique. Fry it up in a pan, Angelique. And never let you forget you're a man.
Give her Angelique, the 8-hour perfume for the 24-hour woman.
That narrative was not nearly as important at that time as the fact in the 70s and 80s that women were entering the workplace and were having a shift in the expectations around femininity, or really just for around their lives. And that, you know, the narratives kind of come along after the fact, after the material conditions change, after the need for, let's say, an expanded labor pool that doesn't distinguish by gender has arisen. And that need, by the way, can arise not only for purely economic reasons, but also after World War II, after women were brought into the workplace because of the war, there was a social demand for the freedom of work. So in any case, it seems like the narratives are sort of retroactive. They come up and they maybe justify or may help you make sense of what's happening materially and socially. But you see narratives as a key to organizing.
They definitely are tools for sense making, and usually they do so retrospectively, just like you said. But in times such as these, the interregnum, the sociological apocalypse, where we are still holding on to the old narratives dictated by capitalism, the hyper-rationalistic financial ones, and at the same time, we lack a tool for sense-making. We really desperately need new narratives. And there is a movement called the Dark Mountain with a writer and journalist, Donald Hine. And they have a website dedicated to this idea. They look for new narratives for new times that would carry thoughts and develop imagination towards something that is beyond this moment right now, the collapse, the apocalyptic moment, but at the same time, which wouldn't mean going back to old and dysfunctional stories, such as the Maybelline woman, which it's quite a dysfunctional story.
When you finished writing your book, when we offered you the contract and how far back that was, because it seems to me that what you're talking about, you know, a book called After the Apocalypse, Finding Hope and Organizing, has a different resonance today than it would have even 6 months ago. So I'm just saying, you wrote this, I guess what I'm getting at is you wrote this before COVID-19 hit the world.
Yes, I wrote it. When was it? Sorry, I have to find the date. 2019. It was written in 2019, the first half of 2019.
So do you feel as though that there might be phases to the interregnum, that the apocalypse, this moment where the old myths and old ways of making sense of the world are falling apart, has now intensified so that no one can deny that we're sort of in an apocalyptic moment? And I say that because, not just because people are getting sick, and not just because we're in a quarantine, but because of the recession that's going to be coming along with that, and also the way in which our daily lives have been disrupted, and some of the very important things that we weren't even thinking about in 2019, like the way that the school system provides daycare and food for students in the United States, for provides their parents with the ability to work. When that institution and that way of life is sort of disrupted, it seems like the ability for sense making falls apart. Or, you know, to put it a different way, I have two older kids who are university students. Both of them, one just graduated and the other is on her way, and they both graduated into COVID-19 or are graduating into the world with COVID-19. And the idea of either going on to graduate school or looking for work both seem like dead ends to them at this moment. And while they're okay, you know, we can help them out, they have sources of income at the moment, there's still this sort of apocalyptic feeling to, like, the whole point of their education was to enter into a world that now seems to have fallen apart. So would you agree that we're, you know, and then you throw in the rioting and the protests and the murder of George Floyd, and it becomes even deeper. But would you agree that the apocalypse has taken on a deeper resonance lately?
Yeah, absolutely. There was a feeling, a strong feeling among sociologists, organization theorists, that something, and economists, that something is going to happen. Perhaps something very dramatic, but of course, we didn't know what. And then the pandemic hit the world, and exactly those things that you described are going on, and I was teaching students almost entirely online this semester, and they were some really very, very good students, wonderfully reflective people. I don't know if they really were different from the students I used to have until now. I did have some very good students before too, but these people were sensitive, imaginative, and very, very reflective. And I'm so sorry that they are graduating onto this world. It seems so profoundly unfair and cruel. On the other hand, after some of the conversations that I had with them, I think I can say I'm slightly hopeful that there is a life after the apocalypse. They seem to have some really good ideas and some really good values that we can perhaps base the world on, the organizational world on. Now, to quote an example, one of my students, and this happened quite recently, I had a conversation with her about management studies, what she believes that students of management should learn about. And she said that the following three things would be the most important for management students to learn. And it's imagination, compassion, and attentiveness.
That those sound like the right things to learn for organizers as well, which is, I guess, a kind of management. So tell me about how you came to turn to an emphasis on the imagination and in storytelling as someone who, let's see, I'm looking at your bio here, has is an organization theorist and who teaches management and organization theory.
It's a consequence of two things. First, my interest in the so-called narrative turn in organization and management theory. There are a lot of people writing about the importance of narratives, of sense-making, of metaphors and archetypes and so on. That's the first thing. The other thing is my ongoing empirical studies. I'm an organizational ethnographer, and I do a lot of field work of different organizations. Since, I'd say, the turn of the century, I've been mostly doing so-called alternative organizations, which are organizations outside of the mainstream, not the big corporations, not the big businesses, but, different kind of organizations, such as cooperatives. And I have been, my attention has been drawn repeatedly to the importance of imagination. People are talking about their dreams, for example, and their ideas, the ideals. It's something that's as important to them as the material reality.
To go back to that Maybelline ad, how do we because one of the things that you can have happen, I think, as you grow up and then, you know, enter adulthood and all of that, is you can have your dreams or what you imagine be shaped by these narratives that have come in based on, you know, the changing material circumstances, and be quite imaginative and productive of stories and ideas and of a future, but have all of those imaginings shaped by the structure of the narrative that you're already within. So, you know, like I can imagine a young woman who says, you know, I'm going to go to New York and I'm going to become a model and a mom. And you know what I'm saying? Like I have this dream of the future. I can imagine myself in a better world, but the imagination is sort of tied to the material reality and the narratives around it that already exist, you know, coming to you from the culture that you're in, the TV, the mall, and so forth. So how do we imagine beyond that? How do we create a new narratives? Do we need to start with imagining, or do we need to start somewhere else?
We can start with imagining. We can also start with working together and trying to express things that are very spatial and very, very embodied. But we can do both these things at the same time. There is a lovely little story by Ursula Le Guin from the 1990s. It's called The Showbiz Story. It's a story of people going into space with using a new technology that never has been used before. It's a kind of a revolutionary drive, which almost teleports them immediately from one point in the universe to another point in the universe, very, very far away. almost immediately, almost without any lapse of time. And so they do that, and their reality collapses. They cannot describe what they see. They see different things. They are unable to interact with the material reality at the point of their destination, because they cannot agree if this reality is shaped in this or another way. So they are not even certain if they can see the same thing, so to say. And in this story, this happens spontaneously, but there arises a need to share the story. That these people gather around, or they gather in a room physically, and they start telling each other the story of what happened. And this is the starting point, so to say, of their journey, which is not just a material physical journey, but it's also a journey in their imagination and in their experience.
Once they start to tell the story together, do they have an easier time understanding and manipulating the material?
Yeah, exactly. That's it. And I think this is such a lovely story for many, many reasons. And it's also a wonderful metaphor of what I believe is happening right now in our organizations. We need those stories, not just for the sake of entertainment or for feeling good together, but we really desperately need them to be able to go beyond the void of the interregnum, the structural void.
Right. Yeah. I feel as though, well, I'm going to just tell you what's on my mind. It's not exactly aligned with the conversation so far, although maybe it is more than I think. But another way to look at this moment is through, again, the lens of Marxism, which I guess is another kind of story, or it's theory and story. But I'll tell you a story. There was this fellow, Heinrich Grossman, who was involved in socialist movements. He was also he was an organizer, and he was a political revolutionary, but he was also part of the Frankfurt School in the very early days of the Frankfurt School. And he had a theory of economic crisis that he thought that actually Horkheimer and Pollock were very critical of, because they thought he was too mechanistic. But what he said was, you know, there are moments that arise within capitalism where it goes into crisis due to the tendency of the rate of profit to fall, you know, primarily. And these are revolutionary moments. These are moments of real break and rupture, but they don't automatically lead to social transformation. This capitalist system can reset itself. There can be a boom. Maybe you don't quite ever reach the point of productivity that you were at before, but it can be reset. But, you know, they represent opportunities for the proletariat movement. And I feel like we are, you know, maybe this is a perverse sort of pessimistic optimism, but that we are in such a moment. And I worry that rather than a coherent left coming together to create an understanding so that we can change our material conditions, that we're going to be entering into a new phase of capitalism. Like, we've gone through the Fordist period, and then there was the neoliberal period, and now that's ending. And so now we're going to be entering into some new period. Like, you know, Lenin said, well, imperialism is the highest form of capitalism, but he was wrong. Because after imperialism, there was the Fordist period and the neoliberal period. So, right. So I feel like we're in a moment of danger where we could miss the moment quite easily. And I wonder how important you think it is to try to come up with stories about this pattern of change. And also, I guess, to go back to Bowman, did he think there could be something beyond liquid modernity that was another form of modernity or another form of capitalism? Did he have any inkling to how that might arise?
Well, his last book, Retrotopia, was about that precisely. What happens if we continue? And his idea was rather pessimistic. If we go on, if we continue doing what we're doing, then we end up destroying Earth. Because of the climate change, because of the destruction of the natural environment. That's exactly what we're doing. And the way that we're dealing with that is by going back, or imagining going back in time, because it's impossible to go back in time, and bringing up old ideas of how it used to be, or distorted ideas about how it used to be, national pride, the great, the United States, the big United Kingdom, and the and so on, and trying to force reality into that not only old but also false picture. So it's like the Procrustean bed trying to fit in something that won't fit in, and killing it in the process. This is what we're doing according to Zygmunt Bauman. The alternative to that is, of course, the democratic form of socialism that we began our conversation with, which is also a possibility, but we need to find a narrative that would compel us, that would be able to carry us through this current void instead of trying to turn back. The temptation is so great to try to turn back time and to make America great again, to make Britain great again, to make Poland great again, and so on, things that were never true in the first place. So I think that on the macro level, this is an impossible mission. Maybe it isn't, I don't know, but it's so difficult to imagine something like that, of that proportions. But I have seen, and I still see as a researcher, quite many organizations, alternative organizations, that are very effective. People are able to support themselves. The organizations are very vibrant. They live, they develop, they are sustainable with respect to the natural environment. And they are good they are good organizations. They are well managed. So this is possible. This is happening. So therefore, instead of engaging in utopian tales, which are important too, of course, and they can be really good, but instead of that, I'm trying to invite people to tell stories about organizing. Quite a practical thing to do.
In your book, you talk about daydreams of the future. Can you give me, do you have any of your own daydreams of an alternative future?
Oh, yes, of course. The one that we have already mentioned before, the one of the commons, of the common good.
But can you tell it to me as a kind of story rather than the kind of abstract way we I thought we might end on that note of you telling the story of an alternative future if you could manage it.
Well, there was once a group of people who didn't want to be alone. And they didn't want to work for a corporation because they felt depressed and forced to do things that they didn't believe in, but at the same time, they needed to support themselves and their families. So they came together and they formed a cooperative. And they liked playing games. They also liked creating games. So they thought they would do educational games. And they were quite good at that. And because they had a lot of friends in the networks among other cooperatives, they were able to sell these games to these other cooperatives, but also to local governments, to schools, and to other organizations. And their fame was growing and developing. People liked what they were doing. And also they had quite a nice Facebook page, which was popular and had a lot of likes, and it was for free. And they were traveling across the country where they were had their headquarters in, and they were also telling people stories about what's so good about learning and education based on games. And they invited people to play games with them. And I think it's been, how many, maybe 10 years, maybe more, they have been operating this way. They are not growing, not very much. They're still just a bunch of people. But they're doing good for themselves, and they're not wasting anything, anybody's time, anybody's life. They're also trying not to waste materials. They're respectful towards each other. And I think they are on the whole, even though they discuss a lot and they talk a lot and they disagree a lot, on the whole, I think they are quite a happy organization.